Brother Jeff, please.
Good evening. I'm just going to tilt this thing up so all my books don't slide off. In considering Psalm 16, well, the reason I wanted to do it as a Bible class was because, well, it appealed to me a lot, and it had so many great ideas and great messages that I thought, oh, this would be a great, great psalm to do for a Bible class. But then when I actually sat down to think about what my message would be and how I would get my thoughts across to you, I realized that it wasn't so clear what one theme I could take out of Psalm 16. Having said that, I think one of the things that stands out in this psalm is that there's this idea of confidence. David has so much confidence throughout this psalm, and I'd like to use the term bristling with confidence. Now, bristling often is taken in a negative fashion. Well, I mean it in a positive way. So, bristling with confidence. But this confidence is linked to something. It's linked to a refuge in God. And so, with the link between these two ideas and taking them as an item, I'd like to consider some of the themes that we come across in Psalm 16. Now, it appears to be a psalm with a mature understanding of life and tribulation and sin and trial. And here I am speaking of this and I'm still young, I think. But I think it's indicative of David's later years. And so when we consider it, we can look to it for advice as if it were from an older brother even. So then, summarizing some of these ideas, some of these pieces of advice that come from our older brother David, I'd like to just go through each verse quickly and give us a general idea of some of the ideas that come out of Psalm 16, and then start to focus in a bit more. Now, verse 1 starts out with a request for help and a trust in God to save, and continues in verse 2 with a confidence in God's ways, and then the idea of a vanity in life without God. Now, some versions are different. The AV puts it quite differently in verse 2. And here we have what I believe between verse 2 and 3 is a logical break between who we're speaking about. Verses 1 and 2, I think, are linked, and they're speaking of God. And verse 3 and 4 are linked, and they're talking about those in the land. And not all the versions agree in this area. And this is a piece of difficult translation that we'll, I think, have to consider tonight. But we'll come back to this. So I'm just going to say that coming into verse 3, we have a concept of blind leading the blind, of shepherds misleading or pagan leaders leading. And in some of your margins, you probably read, my margin reads, "As for the pagan priests who are in the land and the nobles in whom all delight, I said, the sorrows of those will increase who run after other gods," rather than how it might read, "As for the saints who are in the land, they are the glorious ones in whom is all my delight." But we'll come back to this. So considering it as being the pagan leaders, it follows on to verse 4 with consequences of those of misleading the nation into running after other gods. And here there's another interesting twist or usage of language that we're going to consider in the Hebrew. And then there's a resolution in the second half of verse 4 to put those things to one side, to put those things away, to put those things behind. A resolution by the psalmist. And a surety in verse 5 of God's promises, which is a stark contrast to verse 4. Continuing in verse 6 with a joy in God's promises and salvation. And a confidence and thanks to God in verse 7, who can help us to work through our failings, even at the worst of times. And verse 8, the effort that we have to put out, each one of us, to prioritize, to make God our refuge, in order to have such a confidence that he will work through us, help us to work through our failings. And still in verse 8, the resultant success and the reason why. And this ties back to verse 1 again, with the idea of God as our refuge. Verse 9, we have an expression of joy in the inner being from deep within me, from the spiritual man, so to speak. There's so much joy that we have to let it out, the end of verse 9. We want to talk about it. And if we put him first, then he'll help us to deliver it, to develop this. We'll be able to develop this need to speak about the joy that we have in Christ, the joy that we have in the hope that God has offered us. And verse 9, not only is the spiritual man satisfied, but the physical man as well. And this physical is something that's important to us. It's control. The control of the flesh is something that's necessary. And true satisfaction physically means that we have to have things right. God has designed us to be satisfied, truly satisfied, if we follow a certain way. So I can see this as two things: temptation under control, or the idea of eternal life coming, a perfection of our physical bodies. And going on to verse 10, because you will not abandon me to the grave, nor will you let your Holy One see decay. Speaking of a hope beyond death. And I think there's a couple of other definitions, ways of taking this verse. One, we can take it generally as this hope beyond death, or two, messianic only, or three, a combination of both, and maybe it's all three. One doesn't necessarily exclude the other. But as a messianic prophecy, we think of it in terms of the fact that Jesus would not literally experience decay. He wouldn't be in the grave, at least not for long. As kind of a dual, and this just kind of occurred to me, a dual meaning verse, if we take the first half of it, because you will not abandon me to the grave, as personal for each one of us, then it begs the question, why? Why will you not abandon me to the grave? Well, because you would not let your Holy One see decay. In other words, since Jesus wouldn't remain there, then we have this salvation and this hope. Now, I don't know if that's how you understood it or not, but that was a new idea for me. As opposed to just saying, okay, yeah, it's talking about Christ, and it's talking about the fact that he's going to be raised and won't remain in the grave. So Christ is our salvation, and the fact that we're not abandoned, but God has graciously thought of us. And making him our refuge gives us, again, this confidence. And verse 11 goes on to speak of instruction in righteousness, in godly wisdom that's from above. And the Hebrew actually speaks of caused me to experience this path. My version says, NIV says, you have made known to me the path of life. And it contrasts starkly with this experience of death that we see in verse 10. And then going on in verse 11, it echoes verse 2, in fact. If you take the translation that says, apart from you, I have no good thing, we're speaking of vanity in life without God. And in verse 11, we've got the affirmation of that idea, you will fill me with joy in your presence. Absolute joy is what's being talked about here, and it's only experienced in God. It's only experienced with God at our right hand, which follows on to the next, to the last part of the verse and the end of the psalm, that we will always be in the presence of God in the eternal joy to come. And ends on this extremely high note. My version says, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. And that's not this idea of wallowing in pleasure. It's being satisfied in the spiritual man. And the emphasis here is on the quality and degree of this delight that we take in being with our God, but also the eternal aspect of being with our God. And so here we have a lot of ideas to consider and many motivations that can take us, that can help us day by day, I think. Now, we spoke of the first few verses here and how they're a little bit tricky in the translation. And Professor Jeff is going to explain it to you now. I don't mean that, of course. Professor Jeff doesn't know Hebrew, but he's going to tell you what he's found. And this is what I found. Not all the versions jive in these verses 2, 3, and 4. And I don't want to set any one version above another. Obviously, they're all to be considered when you're doing any amount of Bible study. But in this case, the AV links verses 2 and 3. And it says, O my soul, thou hast cast unto the Lord, thou hast said unto the Lord, thou art my Lord, my goodness extendeth not to thee, but to the saints that are in the earth, and to the excellent in whom is all my delight. And to the excellent in whom is all my delight. Their sorrows shall be multiplied that hasten after another God. Their drink offerings of blood will I not offer, nor take up their names into my lips. Now, this verse 2, I was a little confused by, because it says, thou art my God, my goodness extendeth not to thee. And it goes on to link it to verse 3 that says, but the saints that are in the earth, and to them I will extend my goodness. In other words, I'm not extending my goodness to you, but to the saints who are in the earth. And that didn't seem to make sense to me. And I thought, well, maybe you can explain it, the end of verse 2, by going into verse 3 by saying that we can't do good for God directly, but in doing so towards others, we obtain joy in seeing them also following God's ways. But that, it just didn't sit quite right. And verse 2, rather than reading in this way, though thou art my God, my goodness extendeth not to thee, could rather affirm God's position rather than saying that we're not extending our goodness to God. In other words, the way the NIV reads is, you are my Lord, apart from you I have no good thing, and many of the other versions actually read this way, and I don't know what the AV margin, RV margin says. Maybe it's something similar. But it seems to make sense, because when we come down to verse 11, it agrees. You will fill me with joy in your presence. Apart from you, I have no good thing. I see that as a link. A link at the opening and the closing of the psalm. And so, another version says, I say to the Lord, you are the Lord, my only source of well-being. And in fact, the Hebrew actually says, my good, not beyond you, and has this idea of being beyond, and which is probably where the AV gets this extendeth from. But rather than in the AV being no good to you, it's my good is not beyond you. And if we take verse 2 in this light, then it seems that it doesn't flow into verse 3, because we can't say, I say to the Lord, you are the Lord, my only source of well-being, and then go, but to the saints that are in the earth and to the excellent in whom is all my delight. That doesn't work, because we're extending to God, and then all of a sudden we're also extending to the saints. So verse 3 presented yet another problem. And it read, in the NIV it reads, as for the saints who are in the land, they are the glorious ones in whom is all my delight. And that seems to be the more traditional translation, but it seems very disjointed from the flow of the psalm. It would make more sense if we could run verses 3 and 4 together, because 4 seems to be talking about someone that you already know about. Their sorrows shall be multiplied, that hasten after other gods. It seems to be continuing an idea rather than beginning a new one. So, another way of looking at it is, as for the pagan priests who are in the land and the nobles in whom I all delight, I said, and then it follows on to the next part of the verse, falls on to verse 4, the sorrows of those will increase who run after other gods. And that seemed to make more sense, because then verse 3 is establishing who you're talking about, and verse 4 explaining what they're doing. Now, having said all that, and sorry, I was just give you one other translation of it, and that is, as for God's chosen people who are in the land, and the leading officials I admired so much, and that follows on to verse 4, their troubles multiply, they desire other gods. Now, if we take it in this light, I think we can see that it's talking about the bad shepherds of Israel. That it's talking about, or at the very least, pagan priests or someone who's led Israel away. Someone who's been in a leadership position that everyone looked to and led them astray. The NET Bible gives it a personal slant in saying, the leading officials I admired so much. So it even says, well, David even admired them at one point, but realized that they were going the wrong way. So if we take this second interpretation, if we take the second slant on it, what is it we're saying about these leaders? What did they do wrong? Where did they go wrong? How were they led astray? Where was their refuge? Who were they confiding in? Well, they were confiding in other gods, verse 4. Their troubles multiply. They desire other gods. And it's all made all the more potent when we consider that in the Hebrew, it has the idea of marriage, of purchasing a bride. It says their troubles multiply, another they pay a dowry. And that's kind of a more literal translation of the Hebrew, where their troubles multiply, another they pay a dowry. The another could mean simply others, saying their troubles multiply, others pay a dowry, or could go even further and indicate abbreviated phrase of other gods. And for an example of this, we can go to Isaiah 42. In Isaiah 42 in verse 8, and the chapter speaking of servant of God, verse 8, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another or praise to idols. And there's where this concept is linked to idols. So that's another way that we can look at this idea. But even further than that, and as I was mentioning before, it has this idea of paying a dowry. And so it could be referring to something like Exodus 22 verse 16. And we were actually in Exodus 22 in our DVR tonight. Exodus 22 and verse 16, which is talking about responsibilities, social responsibilities. If a man seduces a virgin who is not pledged to be married and sleeps with her, he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife. And if that's the way this is understood in the psalm, that their desire for other gods is, in fact, this idea of paying a dowry for other gods or marrying themselves to other gods, then the idolaters or the leaders and the people who follow them are pictured as bridegrooms paying this price to acquire the object of their desire. And if we relate this to ourselves, to our lives, and how many things we figure, oh, I'll pay the price for that and get what I want. We have to lay that aside if our refuge is going to be in God. If we're going to take refuge in Him and have confidence in Him, then this desire can't be there beside Him. Now, the NIV also translates this verse 4, going back to Psalm 16, as the sorrows of those will increase who run after other gods, who run after. I will not pour their libations of blood on those or take up their names on my lips. And the NIV interpretation seems to leave this idea open a little bit, but does translate it as run after. And if we take it still with the idea of a bride, in the context of a bride, it can be seen that as you might experience anguish, making a quick, rash decision to marry, or rushing into a marriage, let me put it another way. Rushing into a marriage can mean enduring much more hardship and sorrow in the long run, which I think is what we find that this verse is trying to describe as the state of Israel. They've rushed into idolatry and found that they're paying. And of course, we can relate this to ourselves as well. Israel is often described as a bride, as gods, and the church as Christ's. And I think just to take a look at this idea of rushing into things, let's go to 2 Kings 5. And this is the familiar story of Gehazi, where Elijah Where's Elisha? Now I can't even remember. where Naaman is healed of his leprosy. Yeah, it is Elisha. Where Naaman is healed of his leprosy, and Gehazi wants the reward or the compensation that Naaman offers. And in chapter 5 and verse 20, Elijah has already in verse 19 said, go in peace. And, excuse me. And it says, after Naaman had traveled some distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elijah, the man of God, said to himself, my master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. And Gehazi's greed overtook his better judgment in this case. And I find myself asking myself, how many times do I run after something that really doesn't matter in the end? Find myself running after something that is so temporal. Running after the reward that the world offers, which won't last. And this is how the desire of the Israelites was in running after the idolatry rather than making their refuge in God and taking confidence from that. In Jeremiah 2:23, we also see another example. In this case, it's running after something. It's actually running after Baal. In Jeremiah 2 and verse 23, how can you say, I am not defiled? I have not run after the Baals. See how you behaved in the valley. Consider what you have done. You are a swift she-camel running here and there. And in this case, it's speaking of not running after the Baals. Excuse me. One more place I want to go with this idea is Matthew chapter 6. Where Christ affirms this idea of not running after what the world offers us. And a well-known passage in Matthew 6, speaking of worry and the things that we worry about and where we make our priorities, and this links into what links right back into the psalm. Verse 25, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, what you will drink, about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? Then going on to down to verse 31, so do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. We can find it so difficult to seek first after God and not say to ourselves, oh, well, but I really need these things put in line before I do this for God. When God promises us that if we make him our refuge, then our confidence will be in him, and he will provide us with these things. And we talked about briefly about the physical needs that we have, and coming out of the psalm in our discussion of the various themes in verse 9 of Psalm 16, not only is a spiritual man satisfied, but the physical as well. All these things will be added to you. Now, coming back to Psalm 16, this, I will not lift their names up on my lips, that comes up in verse 5 probably refers to swearing an oath on in the name of a deity, obviously another god. And if so, it likely refers to the pagan gods and not the people or the leaders. Now, instead of doing this running after and lifting up the names of other gods on his lips, what has he done? What does the psalmist say? Lord, you have assigned me my portion and my cup and made my lot secure. Or you have given me stability and prosperity. You have given me these things, and you have made my future secure. The verse, if God is for us, who can be against us, comes to mind. It is so secure. It's like the ground under our feet. In fact, the psalmist actually compares, when it says lot, made my lot secure, it's actually compared to a landed property. In other words, the psalmist is picturing God as someone who has cast his lot and thus assured him that he would receive this fertile piece of land, that land is now his. And therefore, it represents security and economic stability, because this is going to be my living, this land. God has given me this land, and now I'm secure. My future is secure. But I think it goes even beyond the temporal future of the psalm to notice that it's talking about land. And it is talking about future, and it's talking about an inheritance. And I think you can easily read into that the inheritance of the kingdom age. And in the same vein, verse 6 continues with the same ideas and same thoughts. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. And another version puts it, it is as if I have been given fertile fields or received a beautiful tract of land. And you might, not only is it a metaphor, I think, but it's also a literal realization of the promise to come. And so we hit this maturity aspect in verse 7. Because seriously, we struggle. And when do we struggle the most is a question we might pose to ourselves. When do we struggle the most? Well, when are we tempted the most? And it seems to me that we're tempted the most at times when we're tired, when we're worn down mentally, late at night. And so we need to analyze our trials before they come, so that when they come upon us, then the circumstances won't sweep us away. We need to make our refuge in God now, so that when these times come, we have something. We have something to respond with. And it's interesting how the Hebrew works in this verse, at least how I understand it. It says, I will praise the Lord who counsels me. Even at night, my heart instructs me. And when we look at the Hebrew, it says, yes, during nights, my kidneys instruct or correct me. And that sounds pretty funny. And I read that and I couldn't believe it. I think, wow, they're talking about your kidneys instructing you. I don't know how my kidneys could possibly instruct me in anything. But it's interesting that they use a lot of idioms that in the Hebrew are referring to the inner man or the inner being. And not only do we read about kidneys, we read about other internal organs as well. And I can't remember the other one that I found. I think it was liver. Liver was another one. In Psalm 7, verse 9, it says, "May the evil deeds of the wicked one come to an end, but make the innocent secure, O righteous God, you who examine inner thoughts and motives." And translated from the Hebrew, it says, "Test hearts and kidneys." But it's been translated, "Examine inner thoughts and motives." So very interesting. And the reason I mention it, besides the fact that it's kind of humorous, is that they saw it as a seat of moral character. This is something that's within you. It's your inner man. And I found myself asking, well, who is my inner man? What is my inner being? Who is our inner spiritual being? And Ephesians 3:16 speaks to this when it says that he would grant you according to the riches of his glory to be strengthened with might by his spirit in the inner man. And that spoke to me of refuge as well. Making God our refuge. For Romans 7 verse 22 in the passage where Paul is explaining the conflict that's going on within him, he says, "For in my inner being I delight in God's law," and we know how it follows, but he speaks of this inner being delighting in God's law. And 1 Peter 3:4, I'd like to go there for a moment. And we've been doing 1 Peter in Sunday school. It's interesting that this came up, and it's talking in chapter 3 about wives and husbands. And when we come to verse 4, and it's speaking of wives, it says, "Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead," verse 4, "it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight." And I don't think it's just speaking to sisters here. I think it's speaking of all of us, that our inner self has to have this unfading beauty of someone who's taken refuge in God. And it is of great worth in his sight. Now, I'd just like to go, well, we'll go back to Psalm 16. Coming out of verse 7, we've thought about temptation, and we thought about even in the hour of temptation, if we've made our refuge in God during the day, he can instruct us at night, that we'll have the spiritual man developed in our inner being. And God promises us that we can get to this point. And that he can help us to maintain this point, because once we get there, we have to stay there. And we have to keep progressing. It doesn't stop. But it takes our own effort of putting God first in our thoughts, in our lives, in our minds. And so that, coming into verse 8, says, what do? We have set the Lord always before us. And again, coming from Matthew, is putting the kingdom first. And all righteousness first. These things will be added to us. And because he is at our right hand, because God's on our side, we won't be shaken. And this is the confidence then that we can take from setting the Lord always before us, continually. And so my heart rejoices, and I'm happy, and my life is safe. This is the verse where it talks about liver, incidentally. My glory is happy. This verse has something to do with the liver. I didn't completely understand it, so I'm just going to mention it as a comment, but this has something to do with the liver. So there you are. Now, some of the other psalms that echo these ideas of resting secure and rejoicing in God are from Psalm 108. I am determined, O God, and I will sing, and I will praise you with my whole heart. And again, this is with this idea of setting God before us, and by doing that, verse 7, when we're in the depths of whatever trial or problem that we might have, our inner man has been developed in the refuge of God, and we can come through it with confidence. And so, we come to the end of Psalm 16. You have made known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. With the godly wisdom that we can take from his word, with his instruction to guide us, we can put our refuge in him and have this eternal delight in him. This is the hope that each one of us enjoys, and the promise that we considered in the psalm of the land should be ever before us.